Welcome to Cockpit to Cowl, the show that explores general aviation safety topics from the combined perspective of flight instructors, pilots, and mechanics, exploring both pilot and aircraft topics to make aviation safer and more enjoyable. I'm Jeff Simon, pilot, AMP, IA, and president of Social Flight.
And I'm Brian Schiff, pilot by trade. I flight instruct and website captainschiff.com.
Well, Brian, we have a lot to talk about tonight, and the basic theme and topic is this concept of trust, and basically when it's good to trust, when it's not to trust, can we trust anybody? And I want to actually start by asking you to tell me a little bit about a story that you were that you'd experienced recently that had to do with, I guess, trust from the cockpit to the ground.
Yeah, there's a lot. I mean, in some cases, you have to trust, you have to do and have faith in a lot of things that are going to go a certain way. And this one involves air traffic control. In this situation that I'm going to tell you a story about is the ATC down in Mexico. No disparaging against our controllers here because they are absolutely wonderful. And to a T, they're pleasant, they're helpful, and they want to help us, and they do a great job. I don't want to disparage air traffic control. I want to make that very clear. But everybody's human. And I think it's very important that as a pilot, you don't just absolutely trust and take for granted that everything you hear from them is okay to do, or every clearance you get is what you should do and okay. And then such a thing happened to me on a flight. And I'll tell you what happened is we were headed down to Oaxaca, Mexico. And it's spelled like Oaxaca, but it's pronounced Oaxaca. And there I was flying down to Mexico, down to Oaxaca. And there's a lot of terrain down there. So the flight involves a lot of risk as far as terrain goes. And I hadn't been down there in a while. But before reaching the Veracruz VOR, which is the upper end of this upper Tango 151 airway, we were cleared direct to the Oaxaca VOR. So from that point, we're not on an airway. And whenever you see the brown stuff on the chart like that, that's a time to maybe raise your spidey senses. A little red flag should raise, and you should just be hyper aware of what's going on. About 30 miles north of Oaxaca, we were cleared to descend to 12,000, cleared for the approach, direct the VOR, cleared for the approach. So here we are going direct to the VOR and cleared for the approach, cleared to 12,000 feet. Initially, the first officer set 12,000 feet, and I'm looking at this going, I just don't think something's not right here. Can we go down to 12,000 feet safely? That's always something you should ask when flying over mountains. Just a prudent question. So here's the approach we were to shoot. We're coming in from the north, northeast, and direct the VOR. And yes, this is just a VOR approach in a big valley like this with 9,000-10,000 foot peaks around it. But this is the only approach they had. It's a VOR alpha approach. So we go to the VOR, we fly outbound, turn around, and come back in while descending. So you can see the VOR here, the approach starts at the VOR at 12,000 feet. So it makes sense that you would be cleared to 12,000, cleared to the VOR, cleared for the approach. Well, okay, that all made sense. But here, we're sitting here over this big brown part of the map that concerned me. So I took a look at it. I'm like, we're not on an airway. And the MEA on that airway was 15,000, actually 20,000 feet. but we're 30 miles north, clear to 12, clear for the approach. And if you take a look at the little box right here, the MORA, or minimum off route altitude, is 14,800 feet. In other words, that's the lowest safe altitude you should go while in that quadrangle if you're not on a published route. So I told my first officer, let's maintain 15,000 feet. Given this more of 14,800 feet until we get to the VOR. And here's why. This is the profile. And this is using ForeFlight's profile to see if we're at 15,000 feet over this section of terrain, the purple section, this is what our 15,000 feet would look like over the terrain. If we're at 12,000 feet, the altitude we were cleared to, you can see we get really close. And this is on the route that we are. A little bit left or right, it could have been catastrophic. But this is the terrain clearance at 12,000 feet. And if you look in there, that's only 1,189 feet clearance from the terrain. So when you're in the mountains, you're supposed to maintain, when IFR, 2,000 feet clearance. Well, we were cleared down to this altitude that put us at 1,189 feet above the terrain if we'd have gone right down to it. Now, there may be a Mexican rule that says if you're not on a published airway, you stay at the Mora until on a published route. Either way, that's my technique. That's what I'm going to do. But don't just blindly follow a clearance down to 12,000 feet. Just some other images that it looks like on that route using the hazard advisor. That's everything above 8,000 feet, everything above 9,000 feet. The blue is our route. Everything above 10,000 feet, everything above 11,000 feet. And see, it's awfully close there. So that's was some time when I really had an eye opener on, yeah, you can trust ATC. Yes, they're doing the right thing, but always be aware of what's going on around you and ask the right questions, especially when there are certain things that set off your spidey senses. So that was just a time, anytime you're not on a published route, please, 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 I'd like to encourage everybody to pay attention to what's below you, the obstacles. How low can you really go safely at that point?
That makes a lot of sense, and it really goes back to the responsibility of the pilot. That's what it screams to me, is
Yeah.
regardless of what you're issued. We've had a lot of conversations about things where you're instructed to turn into something that could be turning into weather or something like
Sure.
this. This is the first time we've talked about something where you were instructed to put yourself in what I would consider to be a hazardous situation with terrain. And it's the same thing. It's that idea of you are responsible, which is going to be a theme, of course, of tonight's show. And that idea that you gotta trust yourself. You gotta trust you're the one with the ticket. You're the one responsible for your own safety. And I'm sure you've come across a bunch of situations like this.
Right, whether it be terrain or weather or airspace or whatever, if you're getting a clearance from air traffic control, most of the time it's going to be the right thing to do. They're quite often never, usually not wrong or don't make mistakes, but we have many accidents that would prove otherwise. So it's just a matter of maintaining situational awareness. Take a clearance and ask, should I be doing that? Every time you get a clearance, is there any reason I shouldn't or don't want to be doing that? Or whatever, for whatever reason, is there airspace there? Is there terrain being the worst? And of course, traffic. I mean, I think it's important for pilots to remember that ATC's role is to separate IFR traffic in controlled airspace. They don't keep you out of the weather. They don't find the most efficient route for you. They might reroute you on a route where you don't have enough fuel. The winds may be worse, or it may be a big roundabout route that you just don't have the endurance for. That's up to the pilot. Obviously, the pilot is the only one who can know these things. It's up to the pilot to accept or deny such clearances, but also being familiar with the rules and regulations. If you're cleared direct to a fix, clear for the approach, what do you do when you get to that fix? Because there are a lot of different rules about that.
Let me ask you a quick follow-up question to that,
Sure.
Brian. What about things that have to do with airspace? Because I've had it recently happen to me where I'm on, well, I guess two different scenarios, but either way, I'm controlled. In one case, I'm on an IFR flight plan. In another case, I'm on VFR flight following with the controller. And they're issuing things, right, about like turn right 15 degrees for parachute jumping or turn left for traffic or whatever. At the same time, in both those scenarios, what are they clearing for you? Because I've had cases where I've looked at it and I've seen I'm going to be in controlled airspace coming up, and I've asked them, and usually they come back and say you're all set. But occasionally I have had them sort of, let's just say, sound surprised, and then say, give me a minute, and then they come back and say you're cleared. Even in IFR, where I've been taken through a restricted area, and I've called and said, are you sure we're okay for this? And sometimes there's a long pause before they come back and say, you're cleared.
Yeah. So the responsibility, I mean, what air traffic control's prime purpose is to keep aircraft operating in the system from colliding. Yeah, they're going to be, if they're in control of the airspace, they're going to clear you in it or clear you out of it. But obviously, in the case of Bravo airspace, you need to hear the words cleared into Bravo, regardless of the vector you're getting, unless you're IFR. That's VFR. IFR, you're going to be separated from other IFR traffic. But it's important to remember that if you're in clear in a million, but you're on an IFR flight plan, you're still only going to be separated from IFR traffic. But guess who can be out there with you doing whatever they want?
Only
VFR
VFRs.
traffic. There's
If you're
no
in an IFR flight, I'm sorry, go ahead.
separation requirement for IFR from VFR, except line of, you know, pilots to see and avoid each other. So even on an IFR flight plan, a pilot is responsible for seeing and avoiding other aircraft in VMC. When you're in the clouds, that's when we rely on ATC to keep us separated from IFR traffic. Of course, we don't expect to see VFR traffic in the clouds. That's why sometimes I feel safer in the clouds than I do out in clear air, because when I'm out in clear air, you know, I feel like I'm in the Wild West. I keep my eyes peeled out the window for traffic.
So quick, you know, confirmation and wrap up on that. If you're an IFR, on an IFR flight plan, do you have any responsibility as individual pilot when it comes to airspace incursions?
I would say yes. You do have responsibility as the pilot in command, because you know, air traffic control can give you a clearance, and there may be an MOA, give you a vector for traffic, and you're pointed right at an MOA. If I saw that, we're not supposed to operate IFR in a hot military operations area. So I would certainly query ATC, or a restricted area. I would query ATC. Okay. Usually when they do that, they'll tell you, oh, this, you know, Hunter MOA is cold, or this restricted area is cold. You're cleared to fly this heading or direct to this fix. If they don't make that perfectly clear and you're headed toward that airspace, I think it's incumbent on the pilot to query them, just like you did, and say, hey, I'm headed toward this airspace. Confirm that I'm cleared to fly into that.
Got it. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I've been vectored many times, IMC and IFR flight plan through MOAs, no problem. I always worried about them. They put you on a vector and there's a lot of prohibited areas also up here. And if you get close to one of those types of things, you know, is it on me to check in and say, are you sure? Like,
sure. It is on you. You're the pilot in command. You're directly responsible for the safety and the operation of that aircraft. Now, I'll tell you a funny story, because I didn't read the entire TFR note one time, long time ago, way, way, way long ago, way before TFRs. I was being vectored by, you know, a control tower headed toward a Disneyland TFR, and I'm headed right toward it. And they said, just fly this heading. And I said, okay, but I'm headed toward the TFR. And I got schooled by air traffic control, and they said, well, if you'd read the NOTAM, and I'd be, okay, you would have seen that as long as you're talking to air traffic control, it's perfectly fine to be flying through that TFR. Well, I learned then, and we all don't read everything, and we're all human. But in any event, I'd still rather be wrong that way, right, than to be wrong the other way, to not ask, but wished I had.
It's funny, because that's exactly the conversation that I was recently having on a flight. We were IMC, IFR, literally they issued a flight plan that was going to take us direct to the DCVOR, dead center, even though the weather was good there. And I literally said to the controller, like, I'm okay doing this, because this would be a really cool photo flight, but are you sure this is really what you want us to do? And he said, well, they'll probably change it before you get there. Which they did.
Right. And that's fine. And remember, a lot of the clearances we get as IFR pilots are just in case. They're only going to happen if you lose your communications. There's usually a bigger plan. And most of the time, that which you've been cleared hardly ever gets flown. It's just in case of loss of communication. There has to be, that's what you fall back on if you lose your comm. And everybody knows what to expect you to do, and you know what they're going to expect you to do. That's why if you get on a vector, you should always find out what that vector is for. Hey, what am I being vectored to? It might be for traffic, but what's the end game here? That's why you'll always hear vectors for the localizer or vectors for the approach, because if you lose your comm, you're supposed to go directly to, you know, whatever you're being vectored to. But I would always ask, I'd always be, you know, always be aware, situationally aware, always ask if in doubt. And there are times when you might get a clearance that's a roundabout, a big area where there's, you know, they say Indianapolis center's closed. We got to take you through Cleveland and Chicago or whatever. And so you get this big reroute, you put in your GPS, and it says more hours than you have fuel in your tanks. You got to say no to that, obviously. And if they can't get you on a different route, you got to find a plan. What's the plan? Well, we're going to have to land in Cleveland or something, get some fuel, or I'm telling you, I can't fly this route. So you've got to communicate with ATC. And if you can't find the right aviation lingo, just talk in plain English. There's nothing wrong with that. The controllers will respect that.
So trust yourself. You are the pilot in command. Don't just trust on others. Trust but verify.
Trust but verify yourself also. You know, find two ways to confirm that what you just calculated is what it is. You know, always find another backup way. So would you trust the guy who's monitoring? Let's say you're flying an airline flight and you've got a, a, novice or apprentice pilot up in the right seat, would you be okay with his instructor, on the ground monitoring him via Zoom? Is that all right with you?
Let's get there in a different way.
I'm just wondering if it gets down to the single pilot, are we going to put, because we have training going on right now. And I think that's very much on the horizon, having a single pilot in an airliner, but having somebody on the ground monitoring five, six, seven, or eight flights. I mean, I think we're getting there, don't you? I think.
I think that there's a lot to talk about when we talk about remote technology and surveillance
Sure.
and video capabilities. There's so much going on. There's so much benefit to it, and it just needs to be carefully introduced. And that has to do with
Sure.
trust. Just like we've said, it has to do with trusting the people involved. Like, what does that mean? Who's in charge, and who are you trusting at that point?
Right. I mean, I trust my mechanic, but I'm still going to do a pretty thorough pre-flight inspection after, it comes out of maintenance. And anytime, I trust myself too, and I put the airplane away, but I'm still going to do a pre-flight next time I go fly it. Always.
Yes.
Sure.
So we've got some news to talk about.
I think we do. Yeah, there's been some interpretations, one of which I'm really happy about, and that was a rescinding of an over of a an interpretation that said an flight instructor is not a passenger. So a flight instructor who wasn't current on their 90-day landings could go up with a student pilot who's not current on their 90-day landings. And I never really agreed with the spirit of that, because the idea is, hey, you need to get up on your landings before you take command of this airplane. But the interpretation, which has been rescinded, said a flight instructor is not a passenger. It's a required crew member. So you're not carrying a passenger. You don't have to be current on your landings, nor is a student. You can't instruct a student. They're not a passenger. Well, they redefined the term student, instructor, passenger. So now basically somebody's got to be current within, three takeoffs and landings within line 90 days. That rescinding of that interpretation, I'm in agreement with.
Excellent. I mean, I agree with that too. And so this is important because we're about to talk about an interpretation that came out on September 3rd, called the Moss interpretation, that
Sure.
affects maintenance and impacts maintenance, certainly. And the first thing is, I want to make sure that everyone has a baseline of understanding what is an interpretation, what it really means. And the concept here is that we have regulations, right? The CFR 14, we used to call them the Federal Aviation Regulations that exist. This is what's been well thought out and existed for decades and decades and evolved over time. But these are the regulations. And yet there still questions will come up about how do we enforce this or what does this mean? And those questions get asked to the FAA's legal group, AGC, and their general counsel. And they go through and take certain questions up. They don't answer everything, but the ones that they do answer, they will issue what's called an interpretation. And that interpretation is, we will, I mean, for all intents and purposes, legally binding because it is the guidance to which the rest of the FAA looks to as to how to interpret and enforce the regulations.
Yeah,
And
and I
so
kind of wish
these
they would
things are really
publish.
important.
I wish they would publish all of those with the regulations. They should kind of be an appendix to the FARs,
That'd be
have all
nice. There,
because you
there's a
need it.
source that you can
Yeah,
look up all the interpretations
sure.
that come out, but they are not in any way directly, I guess there are sources where you can see it. When there's notices of proposed rulemaking that come up, you see this beautiful paper trail that goes this interpretation based on this, based on that, and therefore. But in most cases, it's not like there's a really good pattern of how everything gets connected. And that's
Right.
important too, because the way the regulations work is they're like a web. They're one thing is also controlled by this and this and this and this and this and all these other things around. And so therefore you'll have one regulation that controls one thing. However, somewhere else in the regulations, it controls something else that is directly related to that, which could be something like how you do maintenance versus how an aircraft is returned to service, which we'll talk about, versus what constitutes something being airworthy. So this is all over the place. And again, you can see legal interpretations online. They're easy to find. And I think someone just posted it. So there's
Yeah, and that was actually my cousin who actually shares the same namesake as the interpretation that was overturned, but I'll say for his sake there's no relation.
Yeah, so that's the baseline, right? That's what an interpretation is and the
Sure.
effect it has, which is significant because especially if you wind up at the wrong end of the pointy stick and someone's coming after you, it's going to be your local FSDO that's pointing at not just a regulation, but if for some reason there's some confusion about it, at the interpretation or at any other legal case. So it's really, really important.
Correct. And a lot of them that I think a lot of people who are learning to fly need to be aware of are all the interpretations on logging flight time. There are quite a bit of those. And you need to go look at those because the regs say what they say, but the way that they've been ruled, like you said, the force of law is what how they've been interpreted by the FAA and their legal counsel.
Yeah, it's really important to understand that. And to be clear, I'd say you've got some great, most of the interpretations are just sort of make sense to everybody. They don't really impact anything one way or another. They clarify some things. Occasionally, an interpretation might be a surprise, but in a good way. We had that with the Khalil interpretation that changed how we view preventive maintenance, where we thought it was only these 32 items. And then, boom, all of a sudden, here's this interpretation that if it's really, really similar to one of these and blah, 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 it don't have to be only the 32. And people rejoice.
Right.
But occasionally, one comes out that we view in the industry as being a problem for
Did
us.
one come out that you view as being a
Yes.
problem?
Am I talking about something? Yes, it's called the Moss interpretation. It came out on September 3rd. And essentially, what it did is it changed, or in their opinion, interpreted how supervision has to happen in terms of maintenance supervision. And so I want to share something here to get everybody kind of up to speed on what this kind of means. And so
Okay.
what I'm going to share here is this directly from the FARs. And this is what they were ruling on. They're ruling in a section called 43.3D, and it is this idea of supervision. Now, they were asked, interpretations are always based on being asked something, and they were asked by someone, by a FISDO actually, whether electronic means, whether it be Zoom or any type of video call or anything, could electronic means in any way substitute for in-person consultation, in being in person. And the regulation that they were talking about is this one, which basically says, and I'll read it, a person working under the supervision of a holder of mechanic or repairman certificate may perform the maintenance, preventive maintenance, and alterations his supervisor is authorized to perform if the supervisor personally observes the work being done to the extent necessary to ensure that it's being done properly, and if the supervisor is readily available in person for consultation. The rest of it just basically says, after that, by the way, this cannot be used in any way to deal or address issues having to do with inspections.
So in
So
talking about a person, they're talking about a person, not certificated repairman, not a mechanic.
exactly. And so the reason that the way this has been interpreted for decades, so this goes back 60 plus years, almost 70 years, that this has been the way that life is done. This is basically says that we can train people on the job, we can have apprentices, you can have help, you can have owners doing maintenance on their aircraft, operators doing maintenance that they are not authorized to do themselves. However, as long as they are supervised by someone who is licensed, who is certified to do the task that they are doing, then that's fine. As long as it says, as long as that supervisor is personally observing the work, and this is really key here, to the extent necessary to ensure it's being done properly. That's part one, right? The supervisor has to supervise it to the extent necessary. And then part number two is they have to be, it's really logical, right? Like they have to be readily available in person for consultation. And this is the way life's been, right? And it enables all sorts of situations. You can go in there and work on your plane in a shop. You can do work on your own hangar where you're not authorized to do it, but your mechanic comes in, tells you, this is what you can do right now, like take this apart. And then I'll come back and I'll teach you how to do this. And then they'll, whatever it is, they're using their judgments, goes back to trust. And then they do it to, and then they always have to be available. Now, 70 years ago, 60 years ago, whichever period this was, we didn't have Zoom, video calls, FaceTime, all this kind of stuff didn't exist. You know, now cell phones. So there was the concept was, what does it mean? It was actually the second section of this that they asked about. What does it mean to be readily available in person for consultation? Because that's the idea, not of the supervisor supervising. That's the idea that the person has to be able to reach out. You got to
So
be there if
I'm
they
getting hung up
ask.
on the word extent necessary.
I
What
am.
I'm getting hung up on that because that's a big gray area. Who's going to decide what extent is necessary of supervision? The person signing it off?
Yes. And that's the key. And that's the last part of this because I wanted to just set a baseline before we just
Okay.
kind of dive in and go at it.
Okay.
But here's what's really, really important about this. Maintenance is very different from being in the cockpit. Being in the cockpit, everything
Sure.
is happening real time. Lives are on the line. As a flight instructor, as anything else, it's a different set of rules. You have to be able to dive in. You have to be there. Maintenance, we view all the regulate all the way that the regulations are written is it's two separate things. Number one is 43-3D. This is how you do work. That aircraft under 43-3D that you just finished doing work on, or you even are working on, has no chance of seeing the sky under 43-3D. It has nothing to do with returning an aircraft to service. It's a separate part of the regulations, 43-9, that says here's how you return something to service. And how you return something to service is, you get that logbook entry and that testifying on behalf only of a certified person that says, in fact, I'll actually put it up to show you because this is really, really important. That says that, let me make sure to do this the right way. Here we go. That says that when you put something in there, you have to say what was done. Who performed the work? If it wasn't me, how all that was done? And then you have to write that everything that was done here was performed satisfactory. You are signing in this clause that you are approving it, and your signature constitutes that it is approved for return to service, and that this work has been done in an airworthy fashion, and that this is airworthy. This part that you're doing is airworthy. Really, really, really important, in my opinion, that we understand that that section exists, because that's the key here, and that's what goes back to that first part, which is to the extent necessary, because that's very, very different in every situation, right?
Sure. I mean, I have experienced, and many of my friends have experienced, we get our airplane back from annual or whatever, and it comes back to us in what I would consider an unairworthy condition. So these things happen, and I think they happen. If it happens once, it happens more than it should, obviously. So there are obviously circumstances where a mechanic is signing something off and obviously missed something that either the other person did or didn't do. And then we find it when we get our airplanes back, and it was very disappointing to me in that case. So when I think about anything that can improve safety or increase, so doesn't this make it safer if we're going to have a mechanic work on and look at and observe every airplane being worked on?
Well, so let's go back to the regulation itself. First of all, the world should be safer when people adhere to the rules, right? When people do it right.
Usually, yeah.
Yeah, when they supervise to the extent necessary, and then when they're testifying that something's airworthy,
Yeah.
that they
Yeah.
know that it is when they say that. Well, in the Moss interpretation, they were asked that one question: can we use electronic surveillance methods? And they came back with the following two parts. Which was the first part of their answer said that they found that the phrase in person explicitly requires a physical presence, and that a virtual presence through live video feed or technological means cannot replace a physical preference presence. Now, there was two parts to this. So the first part, I would say the industry found disappointing because there is so much that is done by the FAA and through other parts of the industry. And in fact, there are many, many, many things that are done by airlines, by the companies that make the jet engines, that all sorts of things where they use video technology all the time. So we were very disappointed as an industry that this was part one of the answer. And a lot of people had a problem with it, but disappointment was the best way to describe it. The second part of their answer went past disappointment. The second part was the phrase readily available in person for consultation. Now, remember, this is the idea that the person doing the work who is not certified asks for help. They weren't even asked about this, but okay. Readily available in person for consultation contemplates a physical hands-on approach to supervision. The certified mechanic must be available not just to answer questions, but to notice mistakes and take over if necessary.
Well, that gets really either over-controlling or really gray, depending on the first thing that comes to my mind. But I also like the idea of a mechanic watching someone who's not certified working on my airplane. So where's the problem with that?
So you've got an excellent point, right? So let's break this down to two areas. One is, you said, well, this can be interpreted in a bunch of different ways. So there's a challenge here, because when new words come from the FAA that matter, like an interpretation, if something can be interpreted in a way that might cause a problem for everybody, chances are it will be, and it will be to someone who's going to suffer a consequence for it. And so it's always concerning when something comes out that can be interpreted poorly and implemented in a way that's going to cause regulatory actions on people. The second part, though, is that idea of, yeah, do you want people who don't know what they're doing supervised? Absolutely. And this is where we get back to what I was saying about trust, though. We issue these certificates. We issue a certificate for someone to be an AMP mechanic after all this training. And their license is on the line with everything they do. And we do the same thing for someone to do an inspection who has an inspection authorization. The idea is you trust them, because the regulation says you need to supervise it to the extent necessary, and this aircraft can't leave your shop and go in the air until you testify with your signature that you did it right and that everything was done right and that it meets, that it's airworthy, meets the regulations, meets its type certificate and its type design. And so in a perfect world, the way that this should work is it should be up to that person based on the real world. There's a big difference between the first week in the shop of someone who's a new apprentice who is working towards their AMP and the last week in the shop of someone who's been working for you for 2 years, 3 years, and they're about to test to get their license for themselves.
There's clearly a How big much difference you, there.
Yeah. And there's a big difference between that last person doing an oil change.
Yeah.
Who's done 100 of them or 500 of them. And the first person doing engine work.
Right.
Or doing a cylinder. And we trust that this is going to be done by the mechanic. And I feel like the enforcement of this should be there. We should make sure we have a quality system. We should make sure that we hold those people accountable when something goes wrong because they did something they weren't supposed to, and we have a regulation. But this, all of a sudden, can be easily interpreted to mean if you have to be able to notice mistakes and take over if necessary, what does that mean?
And what does that look like? Does that mean the mechanic is standing there one-on-one with every tech who's working on every airplane or owner?
It could be.
Because
I know of at least one inspector who said that's what they think. So
we have some,
who knows?
We have a lot of very well reputation specialty shops that for different kinds of aircraft, and they have good reputations for being that. So they have a lot of technicians working there, but we have this mechanic shortage. You know, like we got a pilot shortage, we got a shortage of everybody right now. But we know that there aren't enough mechanics in the so the supervision. I mean, obviously that couldn't be possible, but how is it? Shouldn't there be some kind of balance here? Like, how many techs could one mechanic supervise? And if there are way too many, like if you got, 10 mechanics on the floor, 100 mechanics on the floor, or technicians, and one mechanic to oversee 25 technicians, where's the number? I mean, it seems like this could be done in a way that is quantified and makes some sense. It sounds like we went from a mechanic can oversee an infinite number of technicians, but now he can only oversee one. And we went from black to white.
Maybe, and I think that one of the challenges is how did we get here,
Yeah.
right? So we're in a situation right now where pretty much all the alphabet groups are really working together in an incredibly admirable way in a very urgent manner, and in fact have signed on together on a number of letters and petitions, and we're talking about Aviation Electronics Association, AOPA, GAMA, the General Aviation Manufacturers Association, NATA, like all these different organizations, EAA. I was just on the phone with Jack Pelton recently. All these organizations are together because they've actually seen how significant this could be.
Yeah.
But let's keep in mind, this came about simply out of a question about is video equivalent
In
to being in
person.
person for this?
Yeah.
Whereas what I hear you describing is a very, very valid point, which is, should we be taking a well thought out, careful approach to what we should be doing about supervision?
But that's a different issue than was brought up for interpretation, obviously, and maybe one that should be brought to the attention and handled separately. And maybe a team of experts get together and decide, okay, what's the best way to do this? So
Sure,
I
right?
see
You don't
that.
want it coming. Wouldn't that you'd want that to come from a working group, right? Or you'd want that to come from a industry and the FAA or a notice of proposed rulemaking or
Sure.
all these things that are in place. We've got a million things in
Yeah.
place to help make this stuff happen. What's not part of that is one person writing a letter to one office and saying, what does this one word mean? And it changes the regulations for everybody in the in
Right.
one letter.
Yeah. And I saw someone just posted, what about remote towers? That kind of, if you think about that,
Well, that's all. Yeah.
the
One of the
unperson
things I
thing is
wanted to
that's out
ask
the,
you,
yeah.
Brian, is because I've heard a lot of people who have passionately taken the other side of saying, hey, I had bad maintenance done on my plane. I've had this, I've had this bad experience. I'm really in favor of something like this. And I would say again, I hesitate to be in favor of something just because it sort of helped your anecdotal situation, your personal thing, and it fits. If it didn't come through a good, well thought out process necessarily, I look
Right.
at this as you asked a good question about like, is there any limit to it? And I go back and say, how do we approach air safety? Like, shouldn't we be approaching maintenance safety the same way we approach air safety? Accident investigations, statistics, analysis. Do we have a problem? And if so, let's quantify it. Let's
Yeah.
find the root cause of it. And then let's propose how do we work together to solve it? Do regulations have to change? That's one method. Does education have to change? That's another method. Does enforcement have to change of existing regulations? That's another method. There's so many different methods, and we haven't even identified the
Yeah.
exact problem. And here
Right.
we are with all these people. I'll give you an example of a couple of things. One person wrote me an email. He is recovering his plane in his hangar on his own. I won't say on his own. He is doing it under the supervision of a mechanic. This is
Yeah.
going to take many months. He's actually done the work before. And so the way that the supervision is happening in this case is his mechanic comes in and has given him instructions and an education. And he knows what he's doing. And he goes through and does a stage of work. Mechanic then comes back like a week later, maybe 2 weeks later, depending on what's necessary, and inspects everything, looks at how everything's been done, and then tells him what he needs to do next. There is nothing being done on this plane that this guy is not setting eyes on when he comes over. However, this situation, which has been okay for 60 years, of a mechanic supervising this individual to the extent necessary to ensure it's done properly. And then he will come in and do the final inspection and return that to service and make the logbook entry, the mechanic. This is done. This project is sitting on hold. He wrote me, I can't proceed. Like, no one, this is done. And that's because it's hard to argue that with this interpretation that was just written here, that this guy working in his hangar on this recovering, it's hard to say that this certified mechanic is not just available to answer questions, but is can notice a mistake and take over if necessary. Can't, not by visiting once every week.
No, of
And
course
so,
not. And devil's advocate here, when I first heard about that, I thought that's wonderful. I'm putting my life in my airplane. My airplane's going to go into the shop. I like this idea. Of course, this is me thinking about it without the, as I'm listening to you, I hear some ramifications going to happen. I don't know. Does this apply to the airlines too? Does this apply to all the 145 operators? Is the, maintenance shops? I don't know where this goes, but it sure seems like it can have some far-reaching ramifications, and it could reach far into people's pocketbooks. Now, first priority is safety. What is the safest thing to do? But you've got to be reasonable.
Well, I think one of the problems, we're all in favor of safety, and I am in no way defending anyone who doesn't follow the regulations and who puts their signature down on something saying it's safe and it's airworthy, and they don't know if it's airworthy. There's no way I'm endorsing that. But
Well,
we
maybe,
aren't, we're way beyond that now. Now the question is, under this regulation, can a shop afford to have trainees? And
So I
the
think
answer
the
from many shops is no.
so the people like me, who when I first you first told me about this, I said, great, I want a mechanic working on my airplane. I don't want some a person who's learning to be a mechanic or someone who's not certified and all that. And I didn't give it all that kind of thought, but here we have. So maybe we do identify a problem out of this. First of all, fix the interpretation to interpret what was asked. But now we've identified a problem that obviously there is a problem that exists that maybe we now can try to fix. I certainly don't want to get my airplane out of the shop in worse condition than it was when it went in the shop. And I feel like I've had a lot of people reached out to me and said, how could they sign this off? But it was signed off, and it's happening more than it should. I mean, I don't want to throw Boeing under the bus. I mean, they've had their issues, but it happened there. How does this happen? Where do we say this far no further? But I obviously don't want to just draw a line in the sand and say this has got to be what it's got to be, because it happened in a way, from what you're telling me, that it's like one rule was changed because we're asking what this means, and that's not the way it should happen, obviously.
Well, yeah, and also they're supposed to interpret the regulations, not make regulations or not do something that changes it. And the reality is, if you go back to the original regulation, if you go back to the law itself as it stands, it has this section, be available in person for consultation, or it has this section that says to the extent necessary. Well, if you're going to change that and say now something different, what was the purpose of those original clauses anyway? But I do want to address what you've said because it's really, really important. And so the if you've got if the, if we when we have shops, if you go and you pick up something and your aircraft was not done properly and was signed off, there's no defending that. That needs you there's you've got lots of ways to handle that. First of all, I would hope you would talk to the shop. They're supervised by their FISDO, and if they are signing things off that don't meet the basic 43.3 and 43.9 regulations, then we've got a big problem, and that shop will be dealt with by the FISDO. And ultimately, we've got those two things. And of course, if you only want a certified mechanic to work on your plane, vote with your wallet. Like, go to a shop where you talk to them and you say, hey, just like someone wouldn't, just a lot of people say, I don't want to go to a teaching hospital. Choose that you want to go. I don't want to go somewhere where they're teaching mechanics. I want to go somewhere where they only do that. Do it.
And funny thing is, I tell passengers the same thing when they get on the airplane and complain about the seat pitch, or hey, this airplane is tiny because it's a commuter. Well, you didn't shop for the seat pitch or the size of the aircraft. You shopped for the cheapest ticket, didn't you? And I think a lot of airplane mechanic shoppers are probably the same way. Like, I can get my annual done here for $1,200. Well, you're right. Shop with your wallet, pay a little bit more for it if that's what you want. So I can totally relate to that.
And again, I think the big issue here, at least from where I'm coming from, is what is the problem that we're trying to solve? And if so, let's solve it. Let's solve it the right way. Because if a mechanic, any mechanic out there is doing shoddy work and signing something off that is not actually what is signed off, then this letter is not going to fix it. And a different regulation is not going to fix it. Someone who is not doing their job properly is not going to all of a sudden change. We have to enforce what we have,
Right.
or we have to very thoughtfully change it. And I actually think if we very thoughtfully change it, we'll actually start to look at things like, again, you talk about like the airlines. Airlines have an issue on a jet engine. They remote in many cases, the technicians back at the factory that made the engine, who do electronic video and like, can you show me that? Okay, can you show me? Okay, I'm going to approve this variance so they'll let you to keep that engine in service. That part's okay. Fix this. This blade. That happens today. And
Yeah.
so the other problem that the industry has really pointed out is that the many of there have been lawyers at every one of the alphabet groups have poured through this, and they've said, we've got another problem here, and that is this is totally incongruent with all these other things you did, FAA. Like you are saying it's okay for that case where someone's going to use electronic surveillance and a video to look at how a fan blade needs to be done on an airline, and then all of a sudden things are going to get done differently. And now you're saying that this person working in the recovering job can't call on FaceTime and say, tell me something about this. Does this stitch go under or does this stitch go over? And the guy says, let me see it again. No, that goes under. I'll be in on Friday to look at it.
And I guess in this kind of case, you would have to rely on the person looking at the receiving end of that video to determine if that video or that vision, that view is adequate to make that determination. And if it's not, then they'd have to say, I can't tell from the video. Now we need to see it in person.
And my I would like I would rather live in a world where we say all those people are we want them to use their licenses. We train them.
Yeah.
They go through so much training and then they have so much liability,
Yeah.
so much liability, right? And we want them to use it responsibly and say, yeah, honestly, I can't see enough from those pictures. Don't do any more work. I'll come in on Friday. Like whatever. I would rather that world than one where we or the FAA says, no, this is how you do it. This is what you can't do. This is what you can do. Let them use their ticket. And then let's, if
Yeah.
someone's not doing it right and they're doing bad work, in my case, illegally, basically, they're not following the regulations. That's a different issue. That's an individual problem. And if it's
Right.
systemic, let's get a working group together and change the regs.
Yeah, and that makes sense. Yeah, it makes sense. So, what do you see as looking down the road? Because I think I understand that we're not going to have a we're not going to have enough mechanics and IAs to accomplish this. We're going to have a if we think we have a backlog now, I'm guessing that this is going to maybe cause both a backlog and a massive increase in costs. Is that what you foresee if nothing changes, if this really stays the way it is?
So I don't have any indication based on what's happening behind the scenes that this is likely to just stand.
Yeah.
I'm really, really encouraged by what is happening on the back channels from all of these different groups, as to that something's got to change. It would be, and this is just Jeff talking in my opinion, it would be best if they just rescinded this because these get rescinded. It happens regularly if they make a mistake or something else, or because letters get rescinded, as you mentioned in the other case.
It took
And
many years
then,
for that to happen, unfortunately.
well, yeah, would you believe this letter took over 2 years? It took 26 months for this letter to come out from the time it was asked. 2 years plus.
I don't know how long they normally take, but I'm guessing it's not that long.
Crazy. But I would like to see it rescinded, and I'd like to see the concern taken up thoughtfully by a combination, a working group between the FAA and the industry to do that.
Yeah, and
Now,
that makes
that's not what I
sense.
think will happen
Yeah,
because.
I think we also need to maybe have one hour, one class, one unit, whatever, on what this extent necessary means. Because are mechanics trained, or are they just everybody gonna use their own opinions on what is necessary supervision? I feel like there's some kind of leadership training that has to go into place, because these they are leaders. They're leading people who are not technicians. They might just be workers who are taking the panels off for the inspection. They might just have people who don't ever plan on being mechanics. And I know that a lot of that exists, right? So they're leaders.
I mean, I'm more power. I love that, right? And IAs, for example, have to get 8 hours of education every year. And so should we be doing more education in this area and trying to teach more about that? Absolutely.
I wish I only had to get 8 hours every year. Here's the answer, and this is one thing that I've always wanted to see, is that whenever my airplane comes out of annual, the person who signs it off has to go flying with me on the first flight,
There you go.
or an airplane right after a heavy C check on the big jets. Here, go to we need you to do a functional test flight to see if the flight controls work. Yeah, why don't you go with me?
I love that. I think that's great. And you know
No.
what? To everyone who's out there who's an aircraft owner, you have the ability to enforce this because you're the customer, right? That you don't need a regulation for that. You can do it. And so that's, I guess, the key is I'm just in favor of enforcing what we have and teaching. And getting people to do it because what I'm concerned about is can we teach? We should teach people how important this is, make good decisions, but we can't teach people what the answer is for every decision because you've got those two complete variables from the person on day one who you just signed up and doesn't know what an airplane is to the person who is about to take their exam, or the simplest possible task, like you said, removing inspection covers to. The most complicated task that's the most riskiest. And this is, you have the person whose certificate's on the line. They need to make good
Right.
decisions.
Well, with giving the pen, you are wielding a lot of power, and with that power comes responsibility. And I think that teaching a little bit more leadership, a little bit more authority, give them more authority. That's fine. Make it so that they know if they're gonna, just a little bit of training on how to not only lead these people, how to be a supervisor to the people that they're going to sign off on, so that they can determine the level of, whatever the wording was.
Yeah, well, I mean, it makes me think of the idea like scared straight. A lot of FA seminars and things that we go to as IAs are kind of in that vein. They show you like horror stories of this happened and this thing crashed and that happened because their goal is to get your sense of responsibility brought up in a notch. They make you more aware of the significance of your certificate and not be casual. And be really, really careful about what you do. And so, yeah, I think it'd be wonderful to have, and maybe I'll take that nugget and run with that with the FAST team. It would be great to have something that really emphasizes how to make good decisions on that supervision. I think that
And you said something earlier that to that point, you said earlier when we spoke, and I think it's worth mentioning here, is do we want to focus on responsibility or on more regulation? And none of us, I think, want to really be overregulated. There are certain regulations that are necessary. Undoubtedly, we cannot have no regulations. But to the extent that we're talking here, I think responsibility, we need to focus on responsibility and not just put a big old regulation on it, from what I'm hearing from you.
Yeah, and again, everyone can choose their position because as the that's the whole point of the existing regulation. As the certified mechanic supervising someone, you make the decisions to the extent necessary to put your sign on. If you decide that you need to see every single bit all the way, then that is it's your ticket. You my hat's off to you. Do it. And then
So
it's what do you mean?
you said the EAA is involved. Experimental aircraft don't have, I mean, you can work on your own airplane. How does this affect an experimental aircraft? As far as the regulations for
Well, so
working
it doesn't
maintenance.
direct, but I really want to point out the Experimental Aviation Association under Jack Pelton's leadership is far more far larger an organization with far more reach and far more responsibility than just the experimental side of things.
That's fair.
And also, again, we're talking and experimental aircraft get worked on in shops all day long, especially if you're not the original owner,
But would this
or
does this
builder.
really affect them?
I think it doesn't affect a builder on their own. It absolutely affects someone who just went out and bought an RV6 and is getting it done at a shop, or wants to be taught how to work on it if they're not the original builder. So I think there's a lot of folks that it can impact.
Okay. Well, makes sense. I think that we've brought up a good topic. It's obviously good for conversation. I can see a lot of in the chat going up, and I can't even read it as fast as it's going, but I've seen some good points in there and some good counterpoints. And I think the important thing for us to focus is on what's the safest thing to do, but we also need to be reasonable. I'm always for the safest thing to do, and I hate to make a decision based on money. Safety comes first. It's paramount, and I'd like to focus on that, but like I said, how do we do that reasonably? And I think what we've had in place, is it working or is it not? Like you said, we need a study to tell us that. My experience might be anecdotal, and my friends who've had problems, that may be anecdotal, but there may be 15,000 great ones to every one or two or three problem ones.
But even so, I encourage it. Like, think global, act local. Like, we don't want something big happening on this global scale, at least not in my opinion. However, if you get shoddy work done on your aircraft, don't leave it like that. Like, first, maybe talk to the shop, make your own decision. But if this is really something that's happening regularly and the regulations are not being followed, yeah, if it's available to everyone, that
Well, if you're
contact
alive,
VSDO,
if you're alive enough after the airplane has been worked on to talk to the shop, hopefully that the end result isn't something catastrophic and you're
True.
still able to.
But
But
it's the same thing you encounter right at every day at your job and everywhere else. If you see something, if you see a behavior in a coworker or a pilot that you believe may put people at risk, then is the answer some kind of regulation, or is the answer that you've seen something and you need to do something about it to make sure it doesn't happen to someone else?
I agree. If you see something, say something. And we're not trying to promote a world of narcs and tattletales. But when
No.
it comes to safety, we need to self-police or else they're going to police for us.
Well, that's the worry, right? So if everyone says, "Hey, I want this regulation to change because I keep picking up my plane and finding problems," and then the question is, "Well, what do you do about that?"
Fair. First, don't fly it first. But yeah, no, there's so much more to anything than meets the eye. When you first hear about an interpretation and I'm like, yeah, that's great. Good. More safety. That's what I want. But then there's always more to the story. And I think before anybody really reacts to it, it's incumbent upon them to learn what is the issue here? What was asked to be, what was the needed to be addressed? What did get addressed? Then if we discover a new problem, what's the method by which we're going to go and solve that one? So that's
Yeah, it
what we
should
need
be
to
really
do.
interesting. So I'd encourage everybody stay tuned, watch the news. There's going to be a lot coming out, and get your popcorn, because the other thing to watch is there's a lot of politics in this process. I'm not going to lie. And when you watch what happens there, understand that there's feelings on all sides, and so you're going to see it's hard to rescind something. It's easier to say, "Oh, you read it wrong," or "Here's a little clarification of it," or something like that. What we really want, hopefully, is substantive change and a thoughtful approach. What we don't want is a food fight
And I
or
would like to
people worrying about
encourage,
their egos.
well, sure, that's a good recipe for trouble when the ego comes first. But I'd like to encourage, as you and I are talking, pilot to mechanic, that if you're an airplane owner or you rent an airplane that gets worked on, or you have any opportunity to talk to the mechanic working on your airplane, if you don't have an opportunity to make one, I think it's important that you would first start. Open the line of communications. Learn from the mechanic if you're a pilot. If you're a mechanic, go talk to the pilots. I think this intercourse of communication is very important and crucial for someone's going to put in there that I said intercourse. I know it. But this communication between pilot and mechanic is important.
Yeah,
That's
forget
how
about
this starts.
discourse.
Right. Yeah. Is that right? Well, you never know.
Well, the other thing is, I'm going to point out you're wearing a fast team shirt, right? You and I are both fast team folks, and work with fast team, work with the national fast team as well on these types of things,
Yeah.
because not everything has to be the idea that the hammer's going to come down. There's some really, really wonderful, educated, and friendly faces that are involved in the fast team, and especially the folks that are FAA employees that you and I both report to in that role.
Sure.
And I think, if you see something again that's happening, they might be able to help in a way that's not punitive, and that is helpful.
And that's a very good point. I think a lot of people are intimidated to talk to the FAA when really they're there to make everything safer. That's the goal. Now, arguably something you may not be approving of something that they did, but I think talking to them, if you see a problem, talk to the person first where the problem is. Obviously, if you see a shop with a problem, I would always go to them first. How they address that might determine whether or not I go to the FAA next.
The last thing I want to point out having to do with this is, we all pay dues and read the magazines of a bunch of different alphabet groups. And this has, I want to do a real shout out to them of what their value is, because I have been working so closely behind the scenes with each of these different groups and some of the presidents of the groups, the leaders in there, and their legislative and the attorneys working for those groups. And oh man, let me tell you, thank goodness they are here. Every single one of them dove in. We have letters that are so articulate, pointing out things I did not even consider, finding all the different regulations that contradict different things and trying to understand its impact. It matters. This advocacy matters. And the reason it matters so much, and the reason I'm so passionate about this, is because if we don't do something, what really ends up happening is one person gets written up or starts an enforcement action gets started against them. And it's just one guy trying to like make ends meet in his shop, thinking he's doing the right thing. And he's got to pay to defend this. He's got to hire a lawyer. He's got to shut down his shop or do whatever's got to be done. And we all sit there reading articles and eating popcorn. And if we, the whole point of getting ahead of this is to protect all those people so they're not the front line. They're not the one that has to do it. That's why I'm worked up, is because I want to see, I love how have all these organizations have stepped up. AOPA, EAA, AEA, GAMA, NATA, all of these guys. They've all stepped up, and it's to protect those guys, because this is an embattled industry, and we need the help.
It is, and it's a relatively new industry, relatively speaking with all the other industries, but we are also on the cutting edge and the leading edge of the way we operate. The medical industry got checklists from us, and we're doing a lot of things right. We're still learning, and I think that there's going to be a lot more to see here, but I think it's going to be, like you said, it'll be fun to watch, and important to watch too, and to be informed on what's going on and to have a say. We all need to talk to each other and listen to each other.
So certainly send
Yeah.
letters, do what you need to do. I was on a phone with Senator Graves' office of Missouri, who's on the Transportation Committee, House Transportation Committee. Their office is working on it. There's
Really?
tons of people that are up in arms and working on this. But I'd say one of the biggest things is for everyone to stay tuned, write letters, do what they need to do, and be appreciative for all the folks that are going to bat for us. I really do appreciate it.
Yeah, now all these letters that exist, it would be nice. I know, are they public anywhere where people can read them so that maybe they can educate themselves and
I think they
maybe.
will be shortly. I don't know the answer, but if you go directly to those organizations, then I think you can find one. Again, I know GAMA did a letter to the FAA directly, but then there's this group letter from all the organizations going to the FAA, and it's I've seen it, but I think it will be published at some point. And this is just it's all just I'm just glad it's all happening. We just want awareness there, so that
Yeah.
we can build an industry and keep training people, because I want to emphasize this is how training happens. We without supervision, we
Yeah.
can't have training.
That's fair. That's fair. Well, I thank you for bringing it up, and it was a good discussion. I think that there's obviously going to be a more to come here, and it'll be a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to what happens in the next month, and there are some things that I want to talk to you about next month because I got a ton more questions for you as a mechanic And I look forward to talking to you about that.
It's going to be, there's going to be a lot to watch. Grab your popcorn. We are back Tuesday, November 12th at 8 p.m. Eastern time. And we'll be back with another show and maybe an update on this, but certainly we'll switch the subject and dive into a lot more.
Right, but you'll get a survey at the end of this, and if you have any questions or comments, throw them in there. We will read the chat later because it looks like there's a lot of good comments. So, once again, thank you everybody for joining us tonight. Without you guys, we would have no one to talk about all this in front of, and we would just have to go back to our boring old phone calls. So, they're certainly
Exactly.
far from boring.
And I want to point out to everyone also, Social Blight Live, we are back next Tuesday, October 15th. We've got JJ Farighi, CEO and President of Hartzell Propeller here on the show. And then we're off for NBAA, the National Business Aircraft Association's event. Probably see some videos from that. And then on Tuesday, October 29th at 8 p.m., oh, do we have a cool one? The real Rosie the Riveter. This woman
Oh,
is
wow.
over 100 years young and going to join us here on the show. The real, real one of the real, one of the real Rosie Riveters will be here on the
How
show.
cool. That's really
And
cool.
then again, we're back together, you and I, Brian, on Tuesday, November 12th. Man, do I love this show.
Oh, I know. It's going to be a lot of fun. We got a great list of things we want to talk about too. And if you're a ForeFlight user and you're watching the ForeFlight workshops, we'll be doing it again. We did it last night. That's all I'm going to say about last night. We're just going to pretend that didn't happen. We had a fun time, but November 4th, we're going to
You
make up
got
for what
it.
happened last night. So join us on November 4th. If you're a ForeFlight user, just go to ForeFlightWorkshops.com.
Thank you to everyone for taking time out of your evening to join us here on Cockpit to Cal. I really appreciate. I'm Jeff Simon. I'll say good night for me.
And I'll say good night for me, everybody. Thanks for joining us. Have a great one.